You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. My name is Richard Reeves. I'm a senior fellow here in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, and I'm director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative. This event is co-sponsored by the Future of the Middle Class Initiative and by the Center on Regulation and Markets, which is led by my colleague Adam Looney, who you'll be hearing from later. A special thanks to all of you who are physically in the room, who've made the effort to come. I hope you're enjoying our famous coffee and cookies, but I'm aware that there are lots of people watching online. At last count, it was in the hundreds. And so I also do want to thank those who are joining us online as well. If you would like to join in the social media celebration of this event, the relevant hashtag is, and I use celebration advisedly, I mean correctly, it will be a celebration, hashtag housing regs. My job is simply to introduce the event at this point, give you a sense of what's to come, and then I'll be handing over to my colleague. So first of all, you're going to be hearing from Jenny Schutz, who is a Rubenstein Fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program here at Brookings. She is also spending some time now working on the Future of the Middle Class Initiative on issues facing middle class families in terms of housing. She has a new report out just yesterday, which she'll be providing a summary of. We'll then hear from our keynote speaker, California State Senator Scott Wiener. Following his presentation, there will be a chance for Q&A, which I will moderate. And then we're going to transition to two expert panels, one focused on land use and regulation, which we moderated by Jenny. And then the second one, which will be more focused on taxation and how tax affects the housing market, which will be moderated by Adam Looney. As the director of the new project on the middle class, one of the things I've struggled with is defining the middle class. I'm also a recovering Brit. So we're obsessed with class where I come from. And it's been a struggle, frankly. What I've discovered as a new American is that there are approximately as many definitions of what it means to be middle class in America as there are people claiming to be middle class in America, which is approximately 90% of the population. One of my favorite definitions when we did a little bit of qualitative research on this was somebody who has two refrigerators, one of which contains beer. So you have the new refrigerator in your kitchen, but the old one is being used somewhere else to contain your beer. That was proposed to me as one measure of what it means to know that you're middle class. But as the Brookings Institution, we've defined it somewhat differently. We've defined it as the middle 60% of the income distribution by household adjusted for household size and for inflation, etc. So the middle three quintiles. It's not as exciting or as memorable as having a second refrigerator, but it does allow for more analysis. So we're effectively looking at the middle 60%. And the advantage of, we think, one of the advantages of our definition of middle class is that it is in the middle. It clearly expands up 30% up and down, but it is anchored in the middle of the distribution. So for all intents and purposes, that's the definition which I would like you to have in mind, and certainly as we go through Jenny's presentation. Jenny, as I mentioned, is in Metro, but also working here. Previously, she's been a principal economist at the Federal Reserve, has her PhD in public policy from Harvard, and is a welcome addition to our team here at Brookings as a deep expert in housing policy. And so you're going to hear first from Jenny, and then hopefully we'll be hearing from our keynote speaker, Scott Wiener. Jenny, please welcome me in joining Jenny Schutz to the stage.
So now that I know I actually have somebody to follow me, so I have an incentive to finish so you can hear the main attraction of the day. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. As Richard said, we just put out a new report yesterday titled Cost, Crowding, or Commuting, Housing Stress on the Middle Class. So this is intended as a framing paper really to identify what are the sources of housing stress on middle-income families. And as you can tell from the title, they're going to show up in a number of different ways. So I want to start by stepping back a little bit and talking about why we think that it's important to think about housing and middle-class well-being. So housing is one of the three sort of pillars of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative here at Brookings. And we think that it's important to consider how housing impacts well-being. It matters quite a bit for individuals, for families, and for communities. If you live in the Washington, D.C. area, you don't need to be told that housing costs are a major source of concern, not just for low-income families, but increasingly for middle-income families as well. Since we have emerged from the Great Recession, housing costs have been rising generally faster than incomes in most large metropolitan areas. So that's put a certain amount of stress on families. We know that housing is really important for individual well-being for a number of reasons. So first of all, housing is the largest single expense in most households' monthly budget, around a third of their income. That's roughly twice what households spend on, say, food or transportation. So it's a really significant expense for most households. We also know that having a safe, decent quality house and a stable residential environment is important for pretty much everything else that we do. It enables you to get up in the morning and go to work or to school, to be productive, to engage in social life. Where you live determines your access to lots of other things that are place-based. How close are you to jobs? What's the quality of the local public school? Are you in a neighborhood with amenities, with grocery stores and parks and a safe and healthy environment? And finally, for most middle-income families, the equity that they develop through homeownership from paying down a mortgage over time is by far the largest financial asset that they have. So this has really big implications, for instance, for retirement security, for the ability to borrow against housing to pay to send your kids to college. So for all these reasons, we should be concerned about how well households are doing with respect to housing. But it turns out that measuring the degree of stress created by housing is fairly complicated. So typically, indicators of stress on low-income families has focused on how much money are they spending on their rent or their mortgage. So we tend to measure this as a share of monthly income that goes towards housing costs. HUD has established a standard that households spending more than 30% of their monthly income on housing are what they call cost-burdened or indicative of financial stress. For middle-income families, we're going to see that there are a number of ways that they adjust their consumption of housing so they're not spending an excess amount, but we may still be concerned about their well-being. So one of those is that you save money on housing by moving into a smaller home or potentially even taking in additional family members, so moving in with extended family or even with unrelated roommates in order to pool income together. We also know that people have a tendency to go looking for cheaper neighborhoods when housing prices go up. And in most large metro areas, what that means effectively is moving to the outskirts of the metro. So if you move from close to downtown DC out to the exurbs, to Rappahannock and Spotsylvania County, you're going to save money on the rent or the mortgage. On the other hand, you're going to be spending both more time and more money in commuting, which isn't necessarily good either. So these are three measures where we know that there's sort of a direction that indicates more stress. The final metric we're going to look at is homeownership. And that's not necessarily that homeownership is better than renting in all circumstances, but we do know that owning a house, and particularly if you have a fixed-rate mortgage, this provides some insurance against housing costs rising faster than income. So renters are much more vulnerable to costs rising and not being able to meet that. We have also made a number of policy decisions as a country to subsidize homeowners over renters. You'll hear more about that in the second panel this afternoon. And because we are providing special financial benefits to homeowners, we want to be wary of thinking about who's excluded from those subsidies and those benefits. So I'm going to look at these four metrics of housing stress or well-being. And we're going to focus particularly on differences by income, by household type, by race and geography, so that we can think a little bit more about how to tailor policies to meet the sources of stress and the populations who are experiencing stress the most. Give you a quick preview of the key results here. It turns out that most middle-income families don't have a housing affordability problem measured by our standard definition of spending too much of their income on housing. But there are particular kinds of stresses on certain groups. Lower middle-income households are facing direct financial stress to cover housing costs. Families with children are more likely to be crowded, consume not enough space per person. Households living in very expensive metropolitan areas are more likely to have very long commutes. And we see persistent homeownership gaps for younger households, non-white households, and people living in expensive metropolitan areas. So I'll walk through the data behind each of those. As Richard said, we at the Future of the Middle Class Project define middle-income families as the three middle-income quintiles. So what I've done for this analysis is separate households into five income buckets. The three middle ones from the orange through the dark blue are the ones we're mostly going to focus on. This shows you both the poorest 20% and the richest 20% for comparison. So this graph is showing just the standard measure of affordability, how much of income are households spending on housing costs. We have both renters and owners, and it turns out these numbers are quite similar for both of them. So if we look at the orange bar, this is our lower middle income households, and we can see that they are spending more than HUD's recommended 30%. They're actually spending close to 40% of their income on housing costs, so that would suggest there's some financial stress. Once you get into the third and fourth income quintiles, it doesn't look like there's direct financial stress. You can notice, of course, from the bar on the far left, poor families are really stressed over housing costs, right? We've known this for a long time. For poor families, there's an enormous gap between what they earn and the market rate cost of housing. So if we focus just on these three middle income quintiles, what I'm showing you now is breaking them out into how expensive the metropolitan area is where they live. So we want to think about rank ordering metro areas from the cheapest, which is on the left-hand side, all the way through the most expensive. Not surprisingly, if you live in a metro area where housing is relatively more expensive, you have to spend more of your income on housing. So the lower middle income households in the most expensive metro areas are spending well over 40% of their income. Lower middle income households in the cheapest metro areas are a little bit over 30%, but not nearly as stressed. We move to the second metric of housing well-being. This is looking at how much space families have per person. So this is, again, the three middle income quintiles and showing broken out from low-cost metro areas to high-cost metro areas. The top bar here is showing you the average number of persons per bedroom. So HUD defines crowded households as those that have more than two people per bedroom. The average middle income family is living in a home with one person per bedroom, so half HUD's level of crowding, right? So most middle income families have plenty of space, right? We're a country with big houses, so that's not all that surprising. And there's not actually that much variation by income or even by the metro house price level in just the average amount of space per person. But what we do see, if we look explicitly at the share of households that are crowded, that have more than two people per bedroom, that there's a significant relationship both with income and with housing prices. So you can see that the in the orange bars on the bottom here, households in the lower middle income quintile who live in expensive metro areas, about 9% of them are crowded, so not enough space per person. And it turns out that the problem is actually even more specific than that. It's really a problem for families with kids. So here I've broken households into three different groups. One is families that have at least one child under the age of 18, and then childless households are separated out by age, either under 40 years of age or over 40. The yellow bars are the families that have children, and you can see that crowding is almost exclusively a problem to families with kids, and that families without kids, by and large, are not crowded. We can also see that this is related to the house price levels in your metro area. So the worst case scenario are families with kids living in expensive metros, and about 13% of them are living in what HUD would consider to be inadequate space. And this, just to give you a sense of who these households are, the typical household has three adults and two kids living in a two-bedroom space. So you can think of the top graph here as sort of being grandma sleeping on the couch in the living room. The bottom bar shows us essentially the flip side of this, which is households that have excess space. So this is just defined as fewer than one person per bedroom, so you can think of a two-person couple living in a three-bedroom house. It's actually a lot more frequent to have excess space than it is to be crowded. Again, we've got a lot of big houses and we have a bunch of relatively small families. Even in expensive metro areas, more than half of the older childless households have at least one extra bedroom, right, compared to about 13% of families with kids that are crowded, right? So this is just worth remembering that we have a lot of extra space. It's just not allocated evenly across households. And I'm going to talk about this particularly when I come back to the policy implications. What do we think about this distribution of space across households of different types living in the same metropolitan area? We can look briefly at the geographic patterns of crowding, and you'll see that this is not uniformly distributed across the country. It turns out that California and Texas have by far the highest rates of family crowding. We do also have New York on the East Coast, but this is primarily a California and Texas phenomenon. And just to point out that this is not entirely driven by the really expensive metro areas, I've circled here McAllen, Texas, which is one of the lower cost metro areas in the country, but has among the highest rates of crowding, right? So this is a combination of, in some cases, low incomes of families, in others driven mostly by high prices. So moving to the third metric of housing stress, we're going to look at commuting times. And this shows you that on average, middle-income families are spending about 27 minutes one way on a commute, and that there's actually not that much variation in income. So it's not really that all of the lower-income families are living at the in the exurbs and commuting longer distances. There is a relationship between the length of commute and how expensive your metro is. The more expensive metros, people are more likely to drive longer distances, right? So people are looking for cheaper housing in metros that are very expensive. This also has some clear spatial patterns. So we can see that long commutes, this is the share of households spending more than an hour one-way commuting. So this is higher along the Northeast Corridor, big metros spatially, expensive places, and in some cases also people are commuting between metros, right? So you might have somebody who lives in Philadelphia where one person has a job and the other person is commuting to New York for work. But this is also not entirely a result of housing costs. Two of the metros to look at particularly here, Atlanta, Georgia, which is not among the most expensive metros in the country, but is sort of the poster child for sprawl and has particularly bad public transportation infrastructure. People wind up traveling very long distances to get to work. And on the other side of the country, we have Riverside, San Bernardino. So this is the cheaper of the housing markets within Southern California. And there are a lot of people who work in Los Angeles or Orange County but can't afford to live there. So they live in Riverside and have very long commutes. And I'm told by my colleagues who study environmental economics that commuting long distances is bad for the environment. So maybe that's something we want to do a little less of. Finally, our last metric of housing well-being is looking at homeownership rates. This is largely a story of income. The higher the income quintile, the more likely a household is to become a homeowner. This is consistent with prior research. But if we look within income quintiles and break it out separately by race, we also see fairly noticeable differences. For every income quintile, white households are more likely to own their homes than non-white households. And if we look at a specific example here, black households in the third income quintile are actually less likely to own their homes than white households in the second income quintile. And we have a fair amount of evidence that relates this to long histories of discrimination in lending and housing markets. So just to recap the results, most middle-income households aren't stretching just to cover the basic costs of housing, but we do see particular kinds of problems, some of which are national. So lower middle-income households everywhere are stretching beyond HUD's guidelines. Gaps in homeownership for non-white and younger households are also consistent nationally. A lot of the problems we're seeing, though, are really regional, that we see higher rates of crowding and longer commutes, particularly in expensive metro areas. What does this suggest for policy? There's room for policies to address a number of these concerns at different levels of government. So for lower middle income households, we might think about things that can either increase incomes just a little bit, say expansions of the EITC, or maybe decrease housing costs a little. And I'll just point out that for lower middle income households in the least expensive metros, the affordability gap is about $100 a month. So we're not talking about a huge amount of difference. And this is helpful to think about, for instance, policies like making homes more energy efficient, saving some money on utilities could actually do quite a lot of the work to carry the difference between this affordability gap. Because we have these persistent gaps in homeownership by age, by race, by geography, it's also worth thinking about whether there's a role for greater financial stability and support for renters. There's some really interesting conversations going on around the country about providing better tenant protections, protections against eviction without cause. It would also be useful to think about, both for homeowners and for renters, channels of savings and wealth building that aren't tied to homeownership so that people aren't entirely dependent on the wealth they build through their house. And then finally, a lot of the problems really are about states and local governments that haven't built enough housing. So the expensive metros have not been building enough housing to keep up with population growth and job growth. And so ultimately, the only way to fix that is for those states and local governments to build more housing. Hypothetically speaking, if a state legislator in a high-cost state wanted to make it easier to build housing close to jobs and transit, that would be a great step in the right direction. So we're going to hear some more about that from our keynote speaker. And then I'll let you into a little bit of a secret. It's not that we haven't known that this is a problem or that we don't know we need to build more housing, but the politics turn out to be a little bit difficult. So if you think about the graph that we saw with the families with children who are crowded and in the same high-cost metros, all of those older households with excess space, Many of those homeowners have been living in those houses for quite a while. They bought them 20 or 30 years ago. The houses have increased in value, so they've built up a lot of wealth. But that means that homeowners are very resistant to allowing new development that will either just change the character of their neighborhood or, they think, reduce the value of their property somewhat. And I will point out also, if we're making policy recommendations, in hypothetically states like California, people are living in very expensive houses with excess space, but they're only paying property taxes on a really small share of that. So after you get finished passing SB 50 and taking care of the housing supply issue, if you'd like to turn your attention to repealing Prop 13, that would be an excellent next policy step. So with that, the full report is available online, and I'm looking forward to what we hear from our keynote speaker. Thanks.
Thank you, Jenny. Housing matters. Housing matters more today than in the past. Housing matters for middle-class families as well as low-income families. And housing matters for different reasons in different places, as Jenny just outlines. I strongly encourage you to look up the report. It's now my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, who's been semi-introduced already in a very helpful way by my colleague Jenny. And that is California State Senator Scott Wiener. Scott Wiener is perhaps best known in policy circles for his sponsorship of SB 50, which, if passed, will undoubtedly change the housing market in many metro areas in California by allowing more high-density housing around transit areas. He's been serving as a state senator since 2016, representing the 11th Senate District. Before that, he was chair of the San Francisco County Transportation Authority and so on. The full bio is in your packets. But I think it's fair to say that he has a long history of policy interest and action in areas of transport, housing, etc. So Senator Wiener then is a kind of policy wonk. He's a believer in using positive public policy to promote equality, prosperity, and inclusion. But he's also a man of action. When Bike to Work Day was accused of being a sexist institution because it was harder for women to bike to work wearing high heels and with long hair, etc., Senator Wiener joined many other politicians in the state of California to don high heels and wigs and cycle across the bridge to prove the point. Their photos are available online and they're terrific. He's also a deal maker. When his mobile phone was stolen from him, he didn't just run away, as you or I might do. He negotiated immediately with the people that had just stolen his phone. And he negotiated a price of $200 for the return of his phone. They went to the ATM, where he extracted the $200, completed the transaction, and got his phone back. Because it was caught on CCTV, I don't know if all of them were apprehended, but most of them were subsequently apprehended. So these are the kinds of negotiating skills that will be required to bring about serious housing reform in California or anywhere else. And so it's really a pleasure for us to be able to welcome, I think for the first time on a public platform at Brookings anyway, Senator Wiener, who is the scourge of NIMBYs, the whisperer of phone thieves, policy wonk extraordinaire. Please join me in welcoming Senator Wiener to our stage.
Yes, they teach us how to navigate difficult situations in San Francisco, whether you're being robbed or otherwise. It's not a coincidence that people like Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein and Gavin Newsom and Willie Brown, et cetera, all hail from San Francisco. If you can have thick enough skin to make it through, then you probably will do okay. So I want to start with just a story, a little anecdote. Before I was in the state Senate, I was a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, representing the Castro, where I live, and a few other great neighborhoods. And this was back probably in 2014 or 2015, and I was walking down the street near my home, and an older gentleman, probably in his 70s, an older gay man, came up to me, and he said, "Scott, I'm really scared." I said, why are you scared? And he said, "Well, something terrible has happened. My landlord is painting my building." And now, normally, of course, you would think a tenant would be thrilled that the landlord was renting his building. But he not irrationally, interpreted that as he's getting the building ready to be sold, and whoever buys it is going to find a way to mass evict all the tenants, and he's going to have to leave San Francisco because there is nowhere that he could conceivably live, and he's lived in the city for 40 years. So when people sometimes ask me, why are you, you know, willing to, you know, get called every name in the book and get protested and so on and so forth, that's why. Because real people are hurting when it comes to housing. We get very technical about housing, and technical is a good thing. Like, statistics are good. We talk about very technical terms in housing debates about zoning and streamlining, and in California, CEQA, or Environmental Quality Act, about conditional use, about permits, about prevailing wage, all of these technical terms. But it's so important as we talk about housing and as we have housing policy debates in more and more parts of the country that we always bring it back to the real people whose lives are being harmed in real and mean and deep ways by the housing crisis in California, but also in other parts of the country. It really helps, you know, that one of the responses that I frequently provide, both when I was in local government and now when people talk about their concerns about housing development in their neighborhood, I always ask them, is your kid going to be able to move back home and live in your neighborhood or even in your city? And overwhelmingly, the answer is no. And that brings it right down to earth for people. Housing, I'm thrilled that this is happening today, and I'm thrilled that we have presidential candidates now talking about housing and that everyone believes correctly that they need to have a housing platform, because housing for so long has been sort of left out of a lot of our conversations about inequality, around how to lift people up, about how to share prosperity. We focus importantly on things like education and healthcare. That's critically important. But housing sort of takes a back seat, and I think it's been very underappreciated how foundational housing is to everything else. It's hard to be healthy if you don't have stable housing or it's overcrowded. It's hard to get a good education if a kid is waking up every morning in a car or a homeless shelter. In California, at a minimum, one out of 20 school children is homeless, and that is probably an undercount. It's higher than that. And so housing is foundational, and it's finally, I think, getting the attention around the country, and particularly in California, that it deserves. The cost of housing is really, it's having so many impacts. It's absolutely driving people into homelessness. I think sometimes there's a stereotype that all homeless people have some sort of mental illness or drug addiction, and although there's a portion of the homeless population that does struggle with those issues, most homeless people don't. They simply can't afford housing, and so they're living in places we don't want them to live. In California in particular, housing isn't just housing problems aren't just a result of poverty. Housing is driving people into poverty. It's driving children into poverty because the cost of housing is so crushing. It is pushing, as you just saw, more and more people to become what we call super commuters, where they're driving, and that's an hour or more. It's more like 2 hours we're starting to see in the Bay Area and LA, 2 hours each way, which is terrible for the environment, for people's health, and for people's family lives. The challenges we have with housing are making it exceptionally hard for young people to get a foothold, to just be able to get that basic foothold of having housing. You know, yes, they might want to start a family at some point, they want their career, but at some point, you know, living in an overcrowded roommate situation just doesn't work anymore, and we are making it really hard for the young generation to get that foothold. We're undermining our climate goals. In California, although we're reducing and heading towards 100% clean energy in our grid, our transportation sector is going up in terms of carbon emissions. And, of course, our housing approach absolutely perpetuates segregation in a huge way. We have these debates in housing about, is it local control? You know, you're taking away local control by setting state standards. And the local control argument, I think, is one of the most bogus arguments around, and there are very few people who engage in that debate with integrity. It's a little bit like the debate, the current debate, not the past debate about states, right, but the current debate, should we allow the states to do things or should the federal government do it? And you'll notice that it really depends on who's in power in Congress about whether it's state versus federal. No one really, few people fundamentally believe, oh, the states are better or the federal government's better. It's the result. The same is true of state versus local control. I have, in addition to my housing bill, I have a bill to allow people or allow cities to go later than 2 a.m. for their nightlife if they want to. We don't require them to. It's local control bill. Some of the same people fighting me on SB 50 because they say it takes away local control are fighting the nightlife bill because it gives them local control. So the local control issue, I think, really is about results, and we should really focus on the result and stop pretending like there's something biblical about local control when there isn't. Local control is good when it delivers good results, and in California, on housing, it has not. We have to keep hammering away about the truth that housing is a climate issue. And when you look there, in the environmental movement, at times there can be a blind spot around housing and land use patterns. We see it in the Green New Deal, which has there's a lot of great things in the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is silent on housing and land use patterns. It's silent, which I think is absurd, and it needs to be changed to add that. In California's debate about wildfires, land use patterns and housing has been largely absent, and no one wants to grapple with the fact that if you're not going to build in wildfire zones, you got to build somewhere else, and that means more urban density. I think it's important to really, one of the things that really I think is a disservice to housing policy is when any kind of new market rate construction is lumped in as it's luxury housing. It's this sort of disparaging, dismissive, it's luxury housing. And although there certainly are buildings that are built that are luxury housing in the ways we would all conceive, the reality is that new construction, yes, it's expensive, but so are the 100-year-old buildings. In places like Los Angeles or San Francisco or other high-cost areas, everything is expensive because it's scarce. And so some people will say we should only build affordable housing, subsidized housing, but that's never by itself going to get us out of this mess. We have to build both. And then the last thing I will say before I get into some more details is that this is a long-term problem that's been built, and it's going to take a long time to get us out of this. And that's why a lot of politicians don't want to touch housing, because you can't deliver in a year or 3 years or 4 years. You can make some short-term improvements, but this is a long-term project, and yes, it'll probably take decades to move the dial in a place like California when all of us will be out of office. And so that's why people stay away from it. But this is for not just for us, but for our kids and our grandkids. So California is very instructive about what not to do on housing. We used to do it the old-fashioned way. As we grew as a state, we added new housing. And back in the early 60s, we were adding 250,000 to 330,000 new units of housing per year. But then we stopped. We just ground to a halt. And what has that led us to? California has a 3.5 million home deficit, which, to put it in context, is equal to the housing deficit combined of the other 49 states. We are half of the national housing deficit. In homes per capita, California ranks 49 out of 50. In 1960, when we were building all those homes, we had 15 million people. Today, we have 40 million people. But instead of building 250 to 330,000 homes per year, we're now building 77,000 homes per year. We've gone down by two-thirds or three-quarters. And actually, last year it was 77,000. That was down from the previous few. So we're going in the wrong direction. California has one-quarter of the nation's homelessness. We're 15% of the population. And we have half of the nation's unsheltered homeless, half. We have a very high poverty rate, and several million low-income Californians are paying more than 50% of their income for housing. People get this. It is the top polling issue in the state today, which it wasn't 5 or 10 years ago, but we've suffered from political paralysis. So how do we get here in California? And this is where people need to take notes, because it is a cautionary tale. We have over the years, we've developed what I refer to as California's housing last policy, where we have a de facto policy in California that it's not a priority to have enough housing for everyone who needs it. We have created a system that is designed to fail. People sometimes criticize city council members for not approving enough housing, but as they say, don't hate the player, hate the game. We have created a system that has made it impossible for city council members really to do their job. And we ask them to walk the plank every week and vote for projects that people don't want in their neighborhood instead of having state rules like we do with education or health care to help guide and create standards and guardrails so that cities are doing the right thing. Instead, we have a race to the bottom where cities and, frankly, individual neighborhoods can say, I know we need housing, just put it in a different neighborhood. And that happens over and over again in a state of 40 million people, and you end up with a 3.5 million home deficit. So what did we do? We allowed cities to engage in massive downzonings. For example, in the mid-1980s, Los Angeles did a downzoning where it literally deleted one half of its zoned housing capacity, all in one fell swoop. San Francisco did it in the 70s mostly, where we banned apartment buildings in 70% of the city. 70% of San Francisco is zoned for single family or two unit only in this job rich, transit rich area. We invented all sorts of process barriers, our environmental laws, conditional use, appeal after appeal, lawsuit after lawsuit, to say that even if we have zoned for it, we're going to make you run the gauntlet, and you are going to take 5-10 years to approve a project. We've allowed cities to put moratoria on housing. There are cities that have population caps, if you can believe that. I didn't realize that that was a thing, and it's sort of horrifying, but there are cities in California that have that. We have cities that refuse to even adopt a housing element, which is our required housing planning document. And now the new argument that we hear in the Bay Area a lot is the problem is we don't have enough housing. We have too many jobs. And so we need to try to keep new jobs out. And they say that with a straight face. It's the ultimate form of privilege that I have my home. I have my job. I made my money in tech. I'm retired. No more jobs. So not only can our kids not have housing, they can't have jobs either. And they make that it's an actual policy argument, along with supply and demand don't apply to housing. That's another argument that we hear. And, of course, we have our broken tax system, as you heard, Prop 13, which creates a huge incentive for cities to favor commercial development over residential. And now, increasingly, we have the use of impact fees as a way to stop development. I don't oppose impact fees. They play an important role, and cities rely on them because of Prop 13. But we have cities that have fought decades to keep low-income housing out of their neighborhood all of a sudden fall in love with inclusionary housing and put a really high inclusionary percentage in place because they know that it will render projects infeasible. So what do we need to do? There is no silver bullet, and I know SB 50 has gotten a lot of attention, and I, as the author of the bill, you know, it's always nice when people pay attention to your bill, but no one bill or approach is going to fix this. We have to do a number of things. Yes, we need zoning reform. We need faster approval of projects. We need streamlining. It is not acceptable that you have to have 50 community meetings to build a project that's within zoning, and that happens in San Francisco and elsewhere. It's not okay that it can take 10 years to get projects improved. We have to control costs. There's an important conversation happening now in California between labor and the building industry about prevailing wage and having a separate residential wage for low to mid-rise wood frame construction, having a lower wage for that. And that'll open up so many doors if they're able to resolve that. We have to fund more affordable housing. The market, you know, the vast majority of low-income people in California live in unsubsidized housing, but the market is not producing housing affordable to low-income people like it used to, and we need massive subsidies, and that's one area where the federal government can help. And we have to protect renters. In California, very few cities actually have rent control. And so as a result, the vast majority of renters in California can be evicted for no reason and can have their rent doubled or tripled overnight. And we have to really understand that creating new housing isn't about replacing the existing people who live there. It's about being additive. We also have been adding more teeth into our existing laws. California actually went through a period in the early 1980s where we passed various great laws, our state density bonus program, to say that if you have high affordability, you can go taller and get relief from local restrictions. A mandate that cities have to allow in-law units or ADUs, and the Housing Accountability Act, which bans cities from arbitrarily denying or downsizing projects that come forward. They were dead letters for a long time. In the last few years, we're now putting teeth into them, including allowing people to sue cities and get penalties if the cities violate them. Now, about zoning reform, which is what SB 50 is about. I did a streamlining bill in 2017. And I was told, this is great, streamlining is so important, but you have to get it zoning or none of it's worth it. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that zoning, it's absolutely foundational. And we talk about zoning and single-family home zoning or this zoning and that. Let's be very clear in plain English. Zoning is about saying, this is the only kind of housing allowed here. Every other type of housing is illegal, is banned. So single-family home zoning, which is 80% of the state of California, is zoned single-family. As I said, 70% of San Francisco, single-family or two-unit. Same in L.A., 70%. That means that everything else is banned. Apartment buildings, banned. Senior housing, banned. Low-income housing, which is only multi-unit, banned. Student housing, banned. I could go on and on and on. It is all illegal in 80% of California. So that's what we mean when we say a nice word like, oh, it's zoning. People think zoning, that's how you keep like the pig farm out of the middle of a residential neighborhood. No, it's about banning kinds of housing. And that also means banning kinds of people. Because if what you're saying is the only people who are allowed to live in this community are people who can afford a single family home, which I can't afford a single family home in the Bay Area right now, let alone the vast majority of my constituents. You are banning people of who are working class, low income, from your community. And you're banning affordable housing. And so zoning is foundational. So if we're ever going to fill that 3.5 million units, we have to change the zoning. Because otherwise, if we try to do it with our current zoning, it means we're building sprawl. And we're doing what we've always done. We just build further and further out. And those hour to 2 hour commutes start looking angelic. Welcome to the 3 hour commutes. And we cover up farmland, cover up open space, make our overcrowded freeways even worse than they are, and emit even more carbon. So it's not sustainable. And so that's why we are, with SB 50, trying to tackle this in a meaningful way, and that's why it's so controversial. And what the bill does, and we did try last year, it didn't succeed, we're doing it again this year, is to say that if you are near high-quality public transportation, or if you are in some sort of job center, a job-rich, high-opportunity area, you cannot limit density. You can't put an arbitrary cap like only a single-family home, or only two units, or only three units. You have to allow more density. And if it's within a half a mile of a rail stop, you can't push the height limit below 4 stories or 5 stories. This bill is, for California, is a new thing. We've done some zoning overrides before, but never anything like this. But according to studies, this is one of the most probably productive ways of adding a lot of new housing. It does question basic orthodoxies in California. Zoning has always been a jealously guarded local prerogative, but it has become a race to the bottom, and it doesn't work. And zoning reform, I think, has become, there's growing national attention to it. I remember I first started on it in 2014 when I very timidly said, I'm going to do a law in San Francisco to say that you can add a new in-law unit in the Castro neighborhood, where one of the neighborhoods I represent. And that was like this radical thing, and we limited it to one neighborhood. And then you fast forward 5 years, and now we have Minneapolis eliminating single-family home zoning, Oregon proposing to eliminate single-family home zoning. And in SB 50, in addition to the transit and job provisions, we have a statewide fourplex by right provisions. You'll be able to turn any home in California into a four-unit building. So I think we have some momentum and some progress. And then I want to just close by talking about the coalition that we've built. And it took a few years, but it is doable. And I think for a lot of communities, there's I think historically been, it's just opposition. Housing is always viewed as a punishment, right? It's a punishment to have more housing in your community. And we sometimes play into that by saying we're only going to put the housing for cities that have been bad actors in the past, as opposed to where it's sustainable. But we have been able to build a very proactive coalition. And so we have, behind SB 50, a coalition that includes both the California Labor Federation and the California Chamber of Commerce. That does not happen very often, labor and business together. We have both the building trades unions and the California Building Industry Association. And then we have amazing groups like Habitat for Humanity and the UC Students Association, because students suffer so mightily, AARP, and so on and so forth. And so we were able to really, major environmental organizations, we were able to build, I think, what's a very powerful coalition. Without that coalition, this bill would be even harder than it already is. But there's also been a reaction. One of the things that our work has done, I think there's been a lot of good progress, but last year with the bill, it created sort of a conjuring of every anti-growth group in the state. They found each other. It was inevitable. It was going to happen at some point in time, but it happened. I felt a little bit guilty about that, and they formed a statewide coalition called Livable California, which I re-envision as it's livable for people who have housing, California. And they are getting more and more active and threatening a statewide constitutional amendment to try to kick the state entirely out of housing. So we have the reaction that happened. There also is a split within the progressive community. We have progressive groups that are strongly supportive of the work that we're doing. There are some progressive groups who are just fundamentally opposed to market rate housing and will oppose anything that adds anything other than public housing. But then there is a large number of progressive groups in the middle who are very concerned about displacement and gentrification and evictions, but also understand that the general direction we're going in is a desirable one. And so we have built some very strong tenant protections into the bill, some affordability requirements, and I think that's really important because there is a broad housing coalition that can bring many people together, right to left. Housing cuts across partisan labels. It is not partisan in any way. We have some very liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans who work together on these issues, but you have to have a balanced bill that takes into account these needs. So housing is hard. I've had my house, I don't have a house, I live in a condo, but I've had my home, my building protested various times. I feel bad for my neighbors. A terrible group out of LA called the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, a pariah HIV group that is funding NIMBY efforts in various parts of the state, is running TV commercials and sending mail out against me in San Francisco, making horrible claims. So you get demonized, you get beaten up, but it is really, really important. And we know that the polling is there, that even though there's a lot of pressure and negativity around these issues, that the people get it. People understand that we have to do things differently, that the system is broken, and that it's time for real change. So I'll leave it there, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Is this live?
Is it live now? Great. Thank you so much for that keynote. We have about 15 minutes, maybe a little bit more actually, for some questions. So please put your hands up, keep it short, tell us who you are, and make sure it is a question, or at the very least sort of have your inflection rise towards the end of the statement. Yeah, I'm going to start there. Do you mind if we take a couple at the top?
Whatever you want.
Yeah, it's fine. So let's take the gentleman there first. Yeah.
Hi. My name is Ryan Bandari. I'm a senior policy advisor at Third Way. I'm a native of LA, so I know the housing crisis very well.
You bring the mic a bit closer to me.
Yeah. Let's say I'm a native of LA. I know the housing crisis very well there. I'm wondering, how do you go about downzoning? What areas do you choose? Do you start, is it like the richest areas stay zoned, or how do you decide which areas get downzoned or upzoned?
Upzoned.
Sorry.
We don't like downzoned.
Yeah.
Who do you go for? Let's take them one at a time because they're going to be rich, I think.
Sure. So, well, in SB 50, last year we did it just around transit. We said anything that's within a half a mile of fixed rail or ferry terminal, or within a quarter mile of a high frequency bus stop. So a bus stop that's running regularly and it's not one of those like commute only bus lines. That's what gets upzoned. One of the critiques that we got of that approach was that when you look at where high quality transit is, it is disproportionately in lower income areas because wealthier communities have typically kept transit out, sometimes because they don't want people who might take buses to come into their community. It has sort of an ugly history. One of the critiques was this is not equitable. So one of the changes we made to the bill this year is to keep the transit part, but to also add in what we call jobs-rich or high-opportunity areas, areas that have good access to employment, good access to high-quality public schools, economic opportunity, and to try to balance it out. So those are the categories we've used. We also, this year, we have a category of areas called sensitive communities, areas with high concentrations of poverty, high risk of displacement, where we give them a delayed implementation of 5 years so that they can do local anti-displacement planning, and then the bill will go into effect.
Is it fair to say that the answer to the question, should we upzone here, or here, or here? Yes, but to different degrees.
Yes, and so the upzoning that I just mentioned, transit and high opportunity, is a more robust upzoning, but then we recently amended the bill to include a statewide, as I mentioned, a statewide fourplex, so you can do a duplex, triplex, fourplex anywhere, and the reason for that is it's a lighter touch density that will apply in areas that don't have the same access to jobs or transit.
All right, thank you. Yes, sure, but be brief, please. He's asking if it would include Bel Air and places like that.
The statewide fourplex is everywhere, but for the Beverly Hills is included. It's both job rich and it has some transit in it. And the mayor of Beverly Hills, who is an interesting character, has been one of the foremost critics of the bill. So 90210 is covered.
Thank you.
My name is Yaya Fanusi with the United States of Africa 2017 Project Task Force.
I'm sorry, which union?
My name is Yaya Fanusi with United States of Africa 2017 Project Task Force. My one-bedroom condo on Lake Merritt, which I'm renting, I'm losing $1,000 because I don't charge my tenant the going rates. You know Lake Merritt, what it's all about there now, in Oakland. This is a serious issue, and I would like to know, I'm going back to Oakland in June. I would like to talk to you which group I could work with to help people like my tenants to be able to stay there. I'm doing a discount because she's part of this project. Yep. That's why I'm losing $1,000 a month.
Yep.
Right. You're having to do everything today, policy wonk, local advisor, everything. Do you have any brief answers to that, who we could talk to?
There are so many renters who are struggling. Oakland does have rent control, but as I mentioned, a large majority of California renters don't. And rent control is a controversial topic, but I do think it's important to stabilize people in the housing that they have.
Thank you. The gentleman right here on the front, is there a microphone here towards the front? Thank you. And then we're going to go back there. Sorry to make you come up and down.
I can't recall my name is Dave Onspuck, no affiliation. In the early 70s, when I understand, there was a law that I guess was passed that allowed environmental review of projects, and not only do groups like CR Club and all that stuff use that to stop development, but labor unions have used that to try to extort favors from developers about union labor and that kind of thing. My question is, does your bill to help curtail that? I can't recall the name of the one that started all this NIMBYism.
Well, I don't know if it started NIMBYism, but it's definitely has sometimes been used. It's CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. It was signed into law by Ronald Reagan in the early 1970s. And the purpose of CEQA was to say, if you're doing a project, and when people think, you know, building a new highway, building a dam, whatever, you have to analyze the environmental impacts to inform your decision. It makes a lot of sense. It's a very important law. Over time, through court decision, it has grown to encompass a lot of things. In San Francisco, it was used to hold up our bike network expansion, which is, I think, pro-environmental. It is used routinely to slow down or stop infill development, clearly pro-environmental. And so it is a challenge. I mentioned before that there's a negotiation on wages happening between labor and the building industry. If that is successful, I believe it will open the door to meaningful CEQA reform. To be clear, it's not about getting rid of CEQA. CEQA actually serves a lot of really important environmental purposes, but there are times when it's used in the wrong way.
Thank you. The lady there at the back.
Hi, also from Los Angeles. My name is Ife Cade, and I just wanted to know, you said that there's that some communities will have 5 years to work on a plan. I was just wondering if there's funding or technical assistance for folks to do that.
Yeah, so the answer is yes, because we have in the last few years, and Governor Newsom is proposing to dramatically increase the pot of planning money. And primarily it's, you know, smaller cities that often don't have, you know, their planning department is like one person, or they just don't have a lot of resources, and so they haven't updated their zoning in 40 years. They want to, but they just don't have the wherewithal to do it. And so we're trying to, or they don't have objective design standards, so the developers know going in, here are the design rules. And so we're providing more grants, particularly these smaller cities, to help them do that kind of planning. In a place like Los Angeles, Los Angeles has a very well-developed city structure around planning. Yes, there are grants that will be available to help out.
Great, thank you. I'm going to ask my own question now, Senator, and push you on the use of the word bogus to describe some of the local control arguments. That was a very strong statement. I'm reminded of one of my intellectual heroes is John Stuart Mill, and he said, everybody is in favor of devolution down to approximately the level at which they currently sit in the political system. And so people who operate at the state level tend to be quite pro-devolving power down to the state level. If you're in local government, you go down to local. So I don't mean that as a ding against you. I'm sure, because you've proven that you would argue for this anyway. But isn't one of the things that makes American democracy historically so strong the very fact that the default assumption is that power should lie as close as possible to the voter on as many things as possible rather than overriding it?
Right. Just to be clear, I don't believe that local control is bogus. I think many of the arguments that are made are not always about local control,
about something else masquerading as that.
Or about the results. So when people, there are some people who just philosophically believe in local control, and that's fine. Everyone's entitled to their view. It's just that there are people who think, you know, that states are better than the federal government. That's fine. But I have found that very often local control arguments on both sides are not actually about whether local control is good, but about what are the results in this specific situation, which is why I mentioned the example of my nightlife bill, where people who oppose SB 50 for taking away local control are going, like, really spinning around and getting upset that we're trying to give them local control over when they shut their nightlife down. I'm a former local elected official, and before that I was the president of my neighborhood association, so I feel like I've seen, and I was also served on several regional commissions. So I've never been in the federal government, but I've been at like every other level, and I have seen the good and the less good. I happen to think in most cases local communities are in a better position to make decisions than the state is, as mostly the case, but it's not always the case. And on housing in particular, and I've never advocated taking away all local control, even SB 50 retains enormous local control around approving individual projects, local design standards apply, local demolition restrictions apply, local impact fees and inclusionary requirements apply. For the most part, local height limits apply. For the local setback rules apply. So we maintain local control, and that's a good thing. But California's system of local control on housing is extreme. And I mentioned before public education. If I were to come in here and say, I have a bill for you to give pure local control to local school boards, because local control is so incredibly important that they should be able to decide whether they hire credentialed teachers, how many days a year they instruct, and whether they teach math and science. You would laugh me out of the room. We have state standards because it's so important. The same should be true of housing. Standards and local control exists within those standards. The system of pure, unadulterated local control, not just at a city level, but at a neighborhood level, has not worked for housing.
Thank you. Great. The gentleman here. And please, do keep putting your hands up even in between so that I can see where the demand is.
Thank you. Rick Rybeck with Just Economics. Appreciate you and Dr. Schutz mentioning Proposition 13 as something that was promoted to help affordable housing but really has worked to the contrary. There's been a lot less notice of tax reform in Pennsylvania, I'm wondering if you're familiar with it, where they've altered their property tax by splitting it in two and reducing the tax rate applied to privately created building values, which makes things like energy conservation that you were talking about more affordable and economically viable. But because they can't forego the revenue, they increase the tax on publicly created land value. And the thing that's kind of strange is that the lower rate on building values makes buildings cheaper to construct, improve, and maintain. People get that. But surprisingly, higher rates on land actually make land cheaper. I'm just wondering if you're familiar with it or if it makes any sense to you.
I mean, I'm familiar with the idea of taxation and effects on land values. I'm not familiar with the Pennsylvania model. In California, we're very constrained because of Prop 13 in terms of what we can do. There is a constitutional amendment on the ballot next year to remove commercial property from Prop 13. I support that, but with some trepidation because Prop 13 is anti-housing because it makes commercial more lucrative for cities that are struggling to balance their budgets. If we now remove property tax caps only for commercial, it means Prop 13 will make commercial even more, that disparity will grow. So we need to look at broader tax reform, like, for example, the possibility of having regional sharing of, like, sales tax, which, I mean, the pitchforks come out when you mention that, which it's not a criticism. These cities are struggling to balance their budgets because of our tax structure, so I totally get it why they don't like that. But we have to look at these broader ideas of how do we create the right incentives so that they're built, you know, cities want to build housing instead of the next strip mall.
Okay, great. Lady there.
Hello, my name is Rosa Lee, and I'm a PhD student at George Washington University, and I'm writing about American middle class. My dissertation is all about middle class. And I was just wondering around the BLS consumer expenditure data, and I realized that LA and then San Francisco, their share of the expenditure on transportation is much higher for the middle class, and Los Angeles is like 16%, and then San Francisco about like 13%, which is very different from Chicago area, because Chicago area, there's no difference on the transportation cost. So I was wondering whether, like, do you have any like thoughts on this issue? In terms of for housing, it has, yeah.
Right. Well, first, to remember that it's not just about income but cost as well. After all, if everything was free, nobody would be poor. But I just want to say that anybody who comes to an event and says, I was playing around with the BLS's consumer expenditure survey, is always welcome at Brookings. I mean, it warms our heart. I don't know if you have anything on the cost side.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the long commutes is definitely part of that, and all the expenses that are entailed there. Gas prices are higher in California than other parts of the country, we make it hard. But we also in terms of driving, you know, we do rely on bridge tolls and gas taxes to fund our public transportation system. So that does increase the cost of driving, but it allows us to, we hope, make transit more affordable. Another issue, though, is that some of our transit systems receive very little public subsidy and are over-reliant on fares. So BART is the prime example. It gets very little subsidy, and so the fares are way too high, and it's a big problem for low-income riders.
Guy in the blue shirt right there.
Hi, Elon Sykes with the Climate Leadership Council. My question has to do more with a different personal affiliation. So I know that you're involved with the California Jewish Legislators Caucus. And I'm an observant Jew. And it's important to live in a place where I can walk to synagogue. I know that in California, there are lots of Jewish communities in high-cost areas that seem like they would both be a target for SB 50, but also a natural constituency for denser development. So I'm wondering whether there's been any outreach to Jewish communities in California as natural supporters of denser development.
Yeah, well, there's actually a statewide coalition of reform Judaism that is, they haven't endorsed the bill yet, but they've indicated that they're likely to do so. And these are members of our community who are very involved in social and economic justice issues. More broadly, you know, it's been a mix. We have fair amount of opposition coming from some areas where you and my brothers and sisters are abundant. But the opposition comes from other areas where there are fewer of us. So I have not heard that particular argument before. I think it's actually a really good one. I'm going to mention that to some of the Jewish opponents of the bill. So thank you for giving me a new argument.
Next time you come, we expect some theology to be woven into your policy wonkery as well. But with apologies to those who have their hands up, we can't get to everybody, and I'm very conscious of the Senator's time. So we're going to have to close it here and move on to the next panel. But please join me again in thanking our keynote speaker, Senator Scotland. And with that, Jenny Schutz is coming back onto the stage to moderate our first panel discussion. I'm going to leave it to Jenny to briefly introduce the panelists and then moderate a conversation between them on many of what you've already heard about from both our keynote and Jenny herself. Don't forget, especially if you're watching online, you can send questions in using hashtag HousingRegs. Jenny, over to you.
We're finishing up the miking process. I'll just say thanks for sticking around for this. So this is our panel really to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of what are the politics behind current land use, how can we move to a different kind of politics, and what are other ways that we can move the policy needle on land use and housing development. So I have met most of you already. I'm Jenny Schutz. I'm a fellow here at the Brookings Institution. And I'm going to introduce briefly our three panelists. So we have three experts who bring slightly different backgrounds to the table. So to my left is Katie Einstein. She is an assistant professor of political science at Boston University. She studies state and local politics and has written a book that's particularly germane to the topic. So I'm going to ask her to tell us a little bit about her new book shortly. To her left is Marion McFadden. Marion is currently a senior vice president for public policy at Enterprise Community Partners. And before that, she served at HUD in the Obama administration, had experience overseeing affordable housing and community development programs, including the CDBG program. To our far end of the panel is David Schleicher. David is a professor of law at Yale Law School. So he's going to keep us on track every time we propose things that are unconstitutional, which probably will happen.
Left my robe at home, unfortunately.
So. Excellent. David is an expert on land use and both local and state law. So to give you a little sense of the parameters of this panel, there's an enormous academic literature on the effects of land use regulation on housing supply. That land use that Senator Wiener was talking about, bans on apartments and so forth, have driven up the cost of housing and limited the supply of new housing. We are not going to rehash all of the research on the evidence of what land use does. We are going to talk instead about some policy fixes. And there are two areas in particular that I'm going to ask the panelists to respond to. One is to think about how do we change the politics of zoning or the politics of housing at the local level, since most of the decisions are still made at the local level. So what are the kinds of political coalitions and arguments that can be made to change this? And then second, what's the role of state and federal governments? If we can't get local governments to do better on the results, then are there things that state and federal government can do to incentivize changes in housing and land use policy at the local level? So that's sort of the general parameters. We're going to start off on the political side of this, and I'll ask Katie to kick things off. So the title of your new book is Neighborhood Defenders, Participatory Politics and America's Housing Crisis. So I'm wondering if you can just briefly tell us some of the main lessons that you learned. In particular, how does local democracy and the participatory process at the neighborhood level get us to a housing crisis?
Yeah, so this comes from a collaborative project with my Boston University colleagues, David Glick and Max Palmer. And what we're really interested in understanding is the political consequences of our current land use regulations. So there's been this big emphasis, basically, since the excesses of urban renewal, to sort of put planning back in the hands of neighborhoods and to empower neighborhoods to have a say over local development. And this sounds really good, right? Like, this sounds sort of, you know, when a lot of city governments like to talk about, we talk to our neighborhoods. We take into account what neighborhoods think. So it sounds really good in principle when we use this kind of neighborhood-oriented language. But what we find is that in practice, what these neighborhood-level institutions do is empower older white homeowners to dominate land use discussions and to use their power to stop and delay the construction of new housing. So neighborhoods that have a lot of these older white homeowners are able to use land use tools available to them to fight the construction of new housing. And if you live in a community where there aren't as many older white homeowners and maybe there aren't the same land use tools available to you, you, if you're in one of these high-cost metropolitan areas, are going to be the neighborhood that bears the brunt of these development pressures. And so we end up with these really uneven land use patterns where some communities are able to mount these really successful neighborhood defenses while other communities receive the brunt of the development and the gentrification and the displacement that comes with it.
Great. And I'm curious if you can just tell us, so a lot of the research that you were doing was based on community meetings in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has some particular forms of local government. To what extent do your findings translate to other kinds of high-cost metro areas?
So one of the things that we did, one of the biggest empirical parts of this book, is we went and looked at all of the planning and zoning board meetings in 97 cities and towns in Massachusetts. And so we read like thousands and thousands of pages of meeting minutes to understand who these people were, why they showed up, sort of what their main objections were to proposed housing developments. And sort of one important point on generalizability, obviously Massachusetts is, you know, distinctive in a variety of ways. The places we looked at were whiter and wealthier than the country as a whole, but the places we studied are a huge range of communities. So there's some of the really wealthy, homogenous inner core suburbs of Boston that are facing huge housing cost pressures. But we also studied older industrial cities that are really socioeconomically diverse and farther away from the urban core of Boston. So for people who know the region, places like Lawrence, Massachusetts and Worcester, Massachusetts, these are not places that are facing housing crises on the order of San Francisco or Los Angeles. Like, they're very different housing markets. And in every single city and town we studied, the advantage dominated these proceedings. They were consistently dominated by older white homeowners. We felt like Lawrence, Massachusetts was especially illustrative. So Lawrence, Massachusetts is 80% Latino. And over a three-year period, of the 42 commenters who showed up to planning and zoning board meetings, only one of them had a Latino surname. So the underrepresentation of voices of color at these forums and renters at these forums was really stark. And we think that this is a process that generalizes well outside of Massachusetts, that this is something that happens in a variety of different kinds of communities. We also, as part of our research, talked to local officials in many places outside of Massachusetts. So in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, again, not a place that people typically think of when they're talking about a housing crisis, we found that this same kind of process unfolded, where older white homeowners were able to dominate these land use proceedings.
Marion, if I can turn to you. Senator Wiener talked a little bit about the rift in sort of progressive politics at the local level, that very often the debate in places like San Francisco comes down to the yes in my backyard YIMBYs who are saying we want more market rate housing, but they are often opposed by traditional advocates for affordable housing, for subsidized housing, the FIMBYs, public housing in my backyard, and that you wind up with a debate between two groups who in some senses might be allied. So I'm curious if you have a sense, are the goals of more market rate housing and more subsidized housing fundamentally incompatible? Are the groups who are arguing on these sides, do they really have different goals that can't be merged together? Or are these two groups that could be making an alliance?
Well, I mean, I think you're coming right to the cutting edge of affordable housing inside politics, right? So something that's really new and different versus even maybe a decade ago is we are seeing low-income communities and communities of color coming forward and say, don't come here, don't bring resources here, it's going to be too detrimental to us over the long run. And so some of the work that we've been doing in Enterprise is helping communities understand local housing policy tools that they can use to mitigate against displacement with the infusion of new residents. And so there's always going to be a political push and pull. I mean, rare is the place like San Francisco that where people may say no jobs, because generally elected officials and communities want jobs. But there have to be steps put in place far in advance of the arrival of new residents to ensure that existing residents benefit. We see that conversation coming up also around opportunity zones, which are sort of agnostic about the types of investments that have to be made as long as they're in low-income communities, and communities saying, hey, wait a minute, just bringing a lot of cash here could be really harmful.
So in particular, concern about taking some steps before, for instance, an upzoning happens before a market rate development. So it's partly about the timing of the investment and what happens before it.
Absolutely. And just to be a little more explicit, these are things like allowing inclusionary zoning, right? So that when there are new developments, some portion of new development units are set aside for existing residents and affordable to the working class, essentially.
Okay. David, you have written a fair amount about the lack of partisan competition at local elections. So some of the cities where this is playing out, Boston, New York, San Francisco, D.C., the city council and the mayor are essentially all Democrats, and there is at most nominal competition among parties. I'm curious if you see the lack of partisan competition playing into the kinds of solutions, or if you think that there's a different way that that local politics could better represent the different interests.
I think the absence of partisan competition is very crucially related to some of the breakdowns of land use politics in two kind of ways. The first is that heavily interested homeowners are going to be involved in land use politics no matter what. The value of one's home is your biggest investment. The Bill Fischel's home voter hypothesis suggests that these people are going to be in, whereas other interests, whether they're employers, renters, unions, are more weakly attached to housing politics. And as a result, without the mechanisms of party competition or party organization to harness weakly attached preferences on a policy issue, we're likely to see the most heavily invested interest groups win. And so the story about the why you see the biases in who shows up to these meetings, well, they're the ones who are the ones most invested, but we don't have great mechanisms inside local politics for harnessing weakly attached preferences. The second is that we don't have great mechanisms for making deals across neighborhoods. So one of the things we imagine or when we think about land use politics is that we think that perhaps when we say NIMBY, not in my backyard, suggests that you might be okay if it was in someone else's backyard, or as opposed to some of the other acronyms we use, that there might be deals to be struck where everyone would accept slightly higher amounts of housing as long as everyone else was doing it. Political parties are a mechanism for making these cross-urban or even cross-intra-regional deals, and in their absence, or in the absence of party competition, so in many local elections we have no party competition because they're formally nonpartisan, and even where we do, we, as you know, we have only one party usually involved, that these the result in kind of creating the space for land use, the pathologies of land use politics.
So I'm curious if you can elaborate a little bit more. What would be mechanisms for getting people with weaker preferences to show up? So as Katie said, the people who show up at community meetings are homeowners. They tend to be older, wealthier, whiter. How do you get the preferences of renters or in some cases the preference of business to speak louder in the political process?
So our traditional mechanism for making land use changes is the land use amendment, which is locally specific to a neighborhood or, you know, potentially slightly larger than that, but the broader the change, that focusing on amendments activates nearby homeowners who will become unhappy, who are unhappy with the change, but it's usually at too small a level to activate the interests of employers or unions, because you're talking about an employer cares about housing politics because it's going to drive down the cost of housing, which will mean that a steady nominal wage will be a higher real wage, so they can pay their workers more. Or you know, pay them less and get the same amount. Right? The same idea that any individual land use change that's made at the kind of specific, kind of geographically specific zone will not activate the kind of classic growth machine interests, so employers, unions, et cetera. Broader changes, so changes that affect policy everywhere will, in a city or state, will have the effect of it. So as Senator Wiener noted, his bill has attracted the interest of business and of unions that are not usually interested in individual neighborhood-level zoning changes. And so to the extent that policy can be made at a broad level and generalities, it can get these big interests. Again, with renters are kind of a complicated story. They can theoretically be organized, but getting the interests of employers and unions, who are kind of the two classic elements of a growth machine politics, to be involved. And you see this in cities and at the state level. So you see in Senator Wiener's bill has attracted this. But also New York City, with probably the only really major pro-housing, the zoning for quality and affordability, changed zoning categories everywhere in the city at once. People have already mentioned the Minneapolis rezoning, which is a citywide change rather than a neighborhood-specific change. And so that by making changes that apply to a broad swath, that you can really get at housing policy, housing price changes, which will then themselves activate neighborhood big groups as opposed to neighborhood groups.
Okay. So focusing a little bit more on citywide changes instead of neighborhood-specific, where you're really going to get the immediately affected homeowners. I was listening to Senator Wiener talk through the coalition. So he said they have labor unions who are presumably interested both in sort of the welfare of their workers, Chamber of Commerce, which is interested in business being able to grow and employers being able to hire people, local trades who would be part of the construction. I think there was one more, and then sort of the housing industry groups who, again, want to build more stuff. So those are a number of different interesting groups who don't necessarily get involved in local politics. I'm curious from any of you, if you have a sense of, so we have the NIMBYs, the YIMBYs, the FIMBYs, and then the, you know, in the case of SB 50, we have some additional groups. Are there other interested parties, people who would be affected by changing zoning, either changing the way we do it or specific kinds of change, who haven't been actively engaged in the political debate but could be, who either could be drawn in as allies or just who haven't figured out that this matters to them?
So I guess one thing we could think about is changing the way that we have these conversations around housing. So the two really important disparities that we found in our work, one is that these forums overrepresent the most privileged voices, so they're advantaged homeowners, but it also overrepresents opponents to housing. And this totally makes sense. If you think about, you know, a three-unit condominium building getting proposed, you know, three doors down from you, you're going to have to deal with all the construction noise. You're going to have to deal with the parking hassles of having all those construction vehicles nearby. And, you know, in contrast, like those benefits are pretty diffuse, so you're not going to attract a lot of people who are supportive to new housing developments. I also think there's a natural human instinct when we're reviewing anything, like any kind of proposal, you see specifics laid out in front of you, you're going to oppose it. Like maybe this is me as a professor grading student papers, but you give me specifics and my instinct is to find sort of something to critique in them. And so I think we need to have a conversation about how we present ideas to communities and to neighborhoods. And so one thing I've seen urban planners do that elicits more positive feedback is to have these neighborhood visioning processes, where instead of asking people to say, here's a project, do you think this is a good idea or a bad idea for this neighborhood, you instead bring people together. And I saw one where they actually had like a 3D model of the neighborhood, and you say, hey, what would you like to see in this neighborhood? And so at the one I was at, they talked a lot about commercial establishments. They wanted like a gastropub. And so the urban planner who was there then said, hey, if you want this gastropub, you also are going to need a lot more density in this town center. You're going to need to build up to four stories. So, right, it was about sort of the building height. And so I think, you know, it's not necessarily a brand new group of people, but you're reframing the conversation so that a group of people who might have been predisposed to oppose a very specific proposal will instead have something different to talk about.
If you want to have a coffee shop that sells avocado toasts, then you have to have enough people in the neighborhood to use up the avocados.
I would add to that that I think that engagement of the public led to the successes that we're talking about in Minneapolis, also in Seattle, is helping existing residents understand the benefits, particularly with Minneapolis connecting the dots on racial segregation and helping understand the role that the government had and people didn't just wake up segregated and really unpacking that. So We're looking at different cities around the country at how we can break that down. So we've been working with a group called Designing the We on a project called Undesign the Red Line, which has exhibits currently in Boston, Cleveland, Chicago, and Los Angeles, where it really goes deep on the federal government's role and state and local government's role in ensuring segregation across neighborhoods. And when people start to understand that, it helps them loosen up a little bit around, well, maybe it would be okay if the house next door was turned into a two-family or a three-family, because now there's a shared vision, a shared ethics around what kind of community it could be, as opposed to without that kind of a deep understanding and connecting the dots, when people go to, the schools could be overcrowded, the parking could be too much, it could just be too dense for my comfort.
I mean, the group with the most complicated relationship to housing politics in state politics, definitely environmental groups who have a set of cross-cutting interests. And you see this fight between local branches of the Sierra Club and the national branch of the Sierra Club, where you see groups that are mostly concerned about greenhouse gases are very, very pro-development. But people have traditionally joined local branch of environmental groups for anti-development purposes, that if you actually look at the history of anti-development groups, they actually formed frequently as environmental groups. So the LA, the Anti-Hollywood Hills Development Group, started as an anti-branch of the zero population movement. So these people would go to these meetings and they'd be sending condoms to Africa to limit population and opposing development in the Hollywood Hills, and imagine this as part of one political project. And that seems crazy, because it is. But the environmentalism has played an extraordinarily important role in giving people opposed to housing something to say in public. Some people have suggested that what explains the big takeoff in zoning restrictions that we saw in the late 70s and early 80s, they claim two things. One is something about OPEC, but the other one is Earth Day. And so it's that local environmental groups were one of the things was opposing local development. So you see this big conflict in and figuring out ways to activate the greenhouse gas side of environmentalism, which is as opposed to the don't cut the tree down in my neighborhood side.
And we've definitely see that with the groups lining up in support of or opposing SB 50, that environmental groups are split and there are active environmental groups on both sides. So I want to segue now of Marion's comment about what's the role of bringing in higher levels of government. So California is experimenting with this. Local governments have had almost total control over land use and housing decisions. The output has been not great for the state. The state is having difficulty maintaining jobs and allowing workers to retain employees to retain workers. So the state, in part, has a self-interest economically in getting their region to work better and to build more housing. Marion, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your experience at HUD. One of the signature proposals under the Obama administration was the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule, which was at least in part designed to have local governments think about how zoning reinforces existing patterns of racial segregation. Can you tell us a little bit about what the goals of AFFH were and what the mechanisms were that it was trying to use to influence local land use?
Well, I think there are two ways that the federal government really interfaces with local zoning. So Senator Wiener said there's nothing biblical about zoning being a local matter. We should look at the results. Well, certainly there have been times when Congress has said, we need to have civil rights laws and other laws that overlay. And so you'll see that tension with the Fair Housing Act, for example, when communities have large lot sizes or setback requirements, or they fight against including multifamily housing in their areas. And those are areas of general applicability. So it doesn't matter whether HUD is funding that housing or not. Everybody has to abide by the fair housing law. The Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing requirement is an additional requirement that recipients of federal funds face. So just for a sense of context, that's all the states and up to about 1,200 local jurisdictions nationwide. So wide applicability. HUD, however, has had limited enforcement ability, so we've only seen, really a handful of really big cases. But the Obama administration came back to those requirements to affirmatively further fair housing, looked at research about the impact on children's lives, such as Raj Chetty's research, to say we really need to shoulder in and ensure that recipients of this funding are doing what they can to deal with their own patterns of segregation, which are having such a harmful effect on people's lives. And so in part of that work, which took many years of interface with communities and public comment to figure out how to do it. There was a new rule for communities to identify their barriers to fair housing choice, analyze their impediments. And the HUD ultimately, under the Trump administration, suspended the Obama administration rule, but there were communities that created and submitted plans that identified zoning as one of their huge barriers, thinking of like the Kansas City regional submission. Not known as a liberal hotbed, Kansas City generally. But they said, if you really want us to make a dent on segregation in our city, we need to deal with, and we will deal with, some of these big zoning challenges.
So the idea was that local governments that are getting funds directly from HUD would have to identify barriers to racial integration, and if they did not make progress in addressing those, what would be the consequences?
Up to and including not getting any more funding from HUD.
So essentially making federal funding from HUD contingent on reducing barriers to fair housing, including some reform of zoning.
Right.
That's ambitious. That was a big move for HUD. I'm curious, to what extent do you think that, assuming that enforcement of that had gone ahead, how much of an impact do you think that would have, particularly in some of the places that are not building enough housing? Does HUD have leverage on the worst offenders?
HUD has leverage on the worst offenders and the coalition of the willing, right? So part of what the federal government's power is to lift up what's actually working and nudge other communities to emulate that. The process was forcing communities to reckon with their history, to understand what had gone wrong and how it was continuing to have an impact. And there are multiple ways of looking at that across communities. But even just having that requirement there to move towards understanding what needs to happen to change history, that was a really positive step. And so, no, HUD wouldn't have the enforcement ability to go after every community and say, oh, you missed something here, you missed something there. But it was driving forward community change.
Okay. I think the assumption that higher levels of government will always do better has not historically borne out. So that if you look at in the 1970s, there's this big belief that there's something called the quiet revolution in land use, which people meant by the greater involvement of state governments involved in land use. And the interpretation people have given this is, in most cases, it created a double veto, that if the projects were approved at the local level, there'd be another level of review.
So give us a little more information. What were state governments doing that local governments weren't doing?
Environmental quality review is the big one, but there are a whole variety of other process and successive meetings requirements and things that they...
But not superseding them.
No, not superseding them. On top of what there's an instinctive belief that having local governments, that the state has an interest in kind of solving the problem, interlocal problems that you see in local. But it very much depends on what process they create, because state, just as a city can devolve into neighborhood control, a state can devolve into legislator control, where you get carve outs for individual districts. As for the federal government, one of the things that's notable about the Obama-era efforts in this area is that it's a very old law they were seeking to enforce. Right? It's been around for 50 years, give or take, and there had not been much successful enforcement across on affirmative. The part of the law had been there forever, since it had passed. There are real reasons to believe that the federal government will not, in the end, cut funding from jurisdictions because they want to achieve the policy ends of community development and public housing. And so the federal government generally stopping money is something that they're not so good at doing or not willing to do. And so I thought furthering fair housing was a noble effort, but I don't know that it was going to be the be-all and end-all of solving land use politics problems.
At the same time, we did hear from local communities that would say, I need the cover of federal requirement to do this, so I can get my community there, but I have to blame you to make it happen.
So I think eminently blamable. So there you go.
So I think that's an interesting question. The federal government could withhold funds, right? That's something it has the power to do. Whether it has the political will to follow through is another question. And that's a punitive kind of action. But, Marian, you're suggesting that also the federal government, by potentially even by having standards or guidelines, even if they're not attached to direct dollars, could also be nudging local governments in a direction that maybe they want to go. There may be some mayors and city councilors who want to move in this direction, but they're sensitive to the fact that they have to run for re-election. This could be a way of saying, well, HUD says this is good land use and this is good zoning. We should do this. You know, we'll get better treatment from HUD. Do you have a sense from some of the local governments that you were working in, how many of them have mayors and city councilors who kind of want to do the right thing but feel like they can't do it or they'll get voted out?
I mean, I absolutely think this is a really big issue that you worry, particularly if you're in one of these smaller suburban cities or towns, that if you support a deeply unpopular zoning effort, that you're going to get voted out. You know, when we interviewed a lot of public officials as part of this book project, one of the things they talked about at these neighborhood meetings is people would come up to them after a meeting didn't go their way and say, I'm going to vote you out of office. I'm going to take you out of your job. And so I think having that cover absolutely helps. In one area where we can see this happening is actually in school budget override votes. And so oftentimes when we have school budget overrides, it's tied to state funding. A lot of these campaigns will say, you need to pass this budget override or you're going to lose, you know, $80 million in state funding. And so I think that could be a pretty persuasive tactic. And it also gives electoral officials the cover to, in the case of a budget override, to increase someone's, you know, property taxes for a few years.
This raises a really interesting question. So HUD gives, the federal government gives pots of money to local governments through some channels. You know, CDBG is one of the big ones from the federal government. That mostly goes to bigger communities, right? So larger cities or counties, not necessarily to a bunch of the smaller suburban communities, some of whom are very exclusionary. State governments do a lot of redistributive funding through things like schools. Talk a little bit, too, about Massachusetts. So Governor Baker has been pushing for some structural reforms in land use. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this one feels personal. In my town, which is an inner core suburb of Massachusetts, I worked to, along with my committee, to write an accessory dwellings ordinance to try to allow in-law units to be passed by special permit. And we went before our legislative body, which in New England is a town meeting, and we got 62% of the votes in support, which would, you know, normally in a normal legislative body, you'd say, hooray, it passed. Except in Massachusetts and nine other states, to reform zoning in a city or town, you have to get a two-thirds supermajority. And so this ordinance did not pass with 62% of the legislative body voting in support. And so, you know, Senator Reno was talking about a lot of different veto points that prevent us from pursuing progressive housing policy. And it seems like one really important veto point that we have is how easy is it to pass zoning reform at the local level? I mean, first of all, you have to convince a legislative body and an executive body to do it. But then in several states, there's actually, on top of that already challenging process of convincing your legislative body to do this, there's a supermajority requirement, which poses really big obstacles.
So this is a state-level kind of structure of local government, what it takes to pass legislation at the local level. David, I'm curious if you can tell us, how much variation is there across states in the amount of authority that's given to local governments or sort of what extra hurdles they have to jump through?
I mean, there is now quite a lot. Historically, there was very little, which is actually something extremely interesting about the history of the development of land use control, that it's the most successful model act in history, that after New York City passed its zoning law in 1916, soon afterwards, the Department of Commerce under then-Secretary Hoover proposed a model state standard zoning enabling act that was largely adopted all around the country in roughly similar form. And there's some variation. Since the 1970s, you've seen huge amounts of additional stuff added to this, particularly in our highest cost jurisdictions, so particularly in the Californias and New Yorks of the world. I don't know that they're more than that. They're just California and New York. No, it's a...
You could throw New Jersey and Massachusetts
throw in New Jersey and Connecticut a little bit. No, it's... But so there have been things added to this over time that have made the process much more complicated. And the result of this is that we have very different land use policy across the country. So that, as you noted when you put up your broad slides, that the problems of a lack of housing production in terms of its effect on housing costs is really in several metro areas. You know, it's not... In the other metro areas, there's problems of sorting and exclusion from rich kind of tax hoarding. But there's not the effect on the broader housing prices. The effect on regional housing prices is exclusively a California and Acela corridor, with a little bit in like Raleigh, you know, a few places that are kind of on the edge. But it's really just those jurisdictions. And so there's legal process things in some, but not all of those. The other really, there are kind of other ways that land use politics has hit kind of the structure of local government differently. So traditionally, big southern and western cities had very powerful annexation power. And so one thing that you saw in those, that one of the kind of structural regularities of local land use policy is that cities that have lots of undeveloped area don't restrict anywhere quite as strictly because the interests that own property in the undeveloped area are sufficiently powerful, whereas in Boston or in, you know, you have no idea what jurisdiction you're in. Everything was built in the 1600s or, you know, it's been densely populated for a long time. You see a very, very strong NIMBY politics. And so the southern and western cities, because of their broad structure of land use policy, have kind of less restrictive land use outcomes.
We've talked a little bit about what HUD has tried to do or was trying to do to incentivize local government behavior. Is there a role for the federal government moving outside of HUD's purview? Right, one of the limitations of HUD is that it primarily funds urban areas as opposed to suburban areas, and more of its money goes to poor places, which are not necessarily the worst offenders. Is there room for, say, a Department of Transportation to engage with this? We've talked a little bit about some of the environmental impacts of the current development patterns. Could there be a role for EPA? If we were going to really think outside the box, what are the other federal levers that could be pressed to change local behavior? Any of you can tackle that?
Federal expert here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you make a great point about the Department of Transportation and the need to have the community-level conversations about what's going on there. I would just say on the HUD point, one thing that's less noticed about HUD is that tens of billions of dollars, mostly every year, pour in for post-disaster recovery of communities. And their money does go into non-communities, non-low-income communities, right? And it helps rebuild middle-class housing. The current rules allow housing up to 120% of AMI to be assisted with disaster recovery dollars. So we see in areas that have been hit by the worst disasters, huge infusions of cash, which are subject to federal policy. So that's another area where we need to be forward-thinking in terms of what's going to happen in the rebuilding to deal with whatever future disasters are going to come their way, but also how can they solve some of the existing challenges, including the need to create density around transit and the other issues that we're struggling with.
Although going back to sort of the, what's the federal appetite for not providing disaster recovery assistance to places that have just gone through a hurricane unless they reform their zoning?
There's a long history of the effort to use transportation money to incentivize different changes in land use patterns. That's where councils of government largely come from the federal requirement that there be discussions about integrating land use. It's proven to be pretty toothless for exactly these types of reasons, which is there's no formal regulatory. The federal government can't force anyone to change anything, and the federal government wants to achieve the policy end. And so as a result,
Which policy end?
The building the road.
Okay.
And so to condition it on underlying land use changes, people can differ about how effective this is. I think they can differ between not at all effective and barely at all effective.
It's pretty striking that part of what SB 50 is going to do is allow taller buildings,
yes.
if it passes, that it would allow taller buildings around BART stations, and BART was built with federal money. So in theory, it could have been a condition on building the BART stations in the first place to allow the upzoning. We wait until after 30 years of development post the BART system operating before we go back and start attaching conditions. That seems less effective than building it in upfront.
Hindsight is 2020.
There we go. Yeah. Did you have other comments on sort of?
No, I think that, yeah.
Okay.
I think that in general, like, focus on what the federal government can do is fine. There are some things that you could imagine, small policy interventions, races to the top, that sort of thing. And certainly some things on the tax side. But this fight is going to happen in state capitals. And it's going to happen largely in kind of blue state capitals, because that's where we see the most extensive state restrictions, the San Francisco, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts. And the internal progressive fights are where the action is. And the resolving, it's where the action is. And so the federal government, I mean, it's interesting to talk about. We're in Washington and all. But really, if you're interested in these things, you need to be in Albany and Sacramento and other kind of depressing places. Sorry, Sacramento.
I'm curious, California gets a lot of the attention on this, and they've got a lot of activity going on. Are any of you seeing other things happening at the state level that are particularly interesting, either concrete proposals or some of these sort of political coalitions forming around this?
The Massachusetts bill, which does a lot of things, but sort of the biggest, I think most controversial part is it's trying to overturn this two-thirds supermajority, and it's trying to essentially make it so that communities that want to make these kinds of zoning changes can. And this is obviously great to sort of make it easier to reform zoning, but I think fundamentally it's still going to be limited because some of the most expensive and exclusionary places in the state aren't going to magically start coming up with 51% majorities in their legislative bodies. So even if we get rid of the supermajority requirement, there are lots of affluent places that are not going to develop. And so I think we need to be thinking more in terms of preemption or in these kinds of, you frame them as punitive, but sort of ways of structuring funding so that you have to comply with certain inclusionary policies in order to receive funding from transportation or environmental agencies.
I'd add Oregon, which is working on a statewide bill to allow increasing of housing for like duplexes and triplexes in single family zones, not just in its largest cities, but in communities with 10,000 or more residents. And I think that really speaks to the pinch that's being felt across multiple communities. We're not just talking about the highest cost cities that need to look at ways to densify.
I think there's been a really interesting division that the West Coast jurisdictions that have had this problem and have it of somewhat longer standing, California was the kind of original epicenter of this particular problem, or you see pro-housing politics up in Washington, in Seattle particularly, in Oregon, and the East Coast jurisdictions have not. And so we see in Massachusetts is pretty pathetic. New York does not have any such politics of any sort. It's having a big fight about rent control, but nothing really about housing construction. You saw some at the city level, but not all. Connecticut, nothing. And so you're seeing a really big division. And why that is kind of an interesting history, perhaps, but it's certainly the current state of affairs.
Yeah. I mean, New York is an interesting one because, of course, New York City has been really expensive even longer than California has been expensive, but it's mostly been sort of localized to the city. I'm wondering if it's presumably the rural communities, Albany, Rochester, are not getting in on this fight.
New York City's been rich. Where most people live in New York State is downstate, and people think New York City is a relatively pro-growth jurisdiction. It's not at all. New York City per capita builds half as much housing as San Francisco. So it is a way slower growth jurisdiction than even in San Francisco. And San Francisco isn't really the bar you'd set yourself at. But New York is extremely – its suburbs particularly are extremely slow growth, that there's more housing construction. In the mid-2000s, there's a five-year ban where there's more housing construction in Newark, New Jersey than there was in all of Nassau County. Nassau County is very big, and Newark, New Jersey is not very big. And so you see really, really big – it's a very, very slow growth jurisdiction over time, and really since the 1961 rezoning, which really radically restricted development in the city. Up until then, it had been pretty pro-growth.
Okay. So I'm going to ask the panel one more question and then throw it open to you guys. You can be thinking of your questions to ask. So although we sort of are agreed that there's more potential for effective activity at the state level, housing is starting to get more attention in the national political cycle than it's gotten in a very long time. I'm curious if you are hearing things that sound promising from candidates, or if there are things that you would like people to be proposing as they're running for office that they haven't yet said. So it's your chance to give free advice to everybody running for president in 2020.
So I think one of the things, as I listen to national level conversations, but frankly conversations that are happening at the state and local level too, that's been frustrating about housing policy is how much it's been divorced from conversations about climate policy. So when we have conferences, right, it's either a housing conference or it's a climate conference. When we hear politicians talk about climate policy, they're not usually talking about housing policy. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal got some early criticism because it wasn't talking as much about sort of transit-oriented development and how do we build more housing in places that are environmentally sustainable. And so I would love to see, if we're talking about sort of the 2020 election, presidential candidates sort of take those two conversations jointly and think about those issues together.
Having worked in this field for like more than 20 years, I can't get over my excitement just that it's being talked about, right? I mean, this is so different and so new. It's also really grim, of course, that it has the housing problem has become so big that it's bubbled up into the common vernacular. But I think at this stage in the debate, it's just the most important thing that they start to talk about it. Because there is such a crowded field among Democrats, right, it's not the time to get super specialized about your plan versus your plan versus your plan, because they need to differentiate themselves from one another. But I would say generally, we want to ensure that there are policies for production of new housing, preservation of existing housing, and tenant protections. Tenant protections are probably mostly going to fall to local decision making, but really ensuring that there are big policies for big dollar solutions, because it's felt all over the country, and it's not just the urban cores, but all across all types of communities.
My buy venture is that they, instead of running for president, they should run for governor, which would be a solution to some of their problems.
Some of them are governors.
Right? So they should stay. Now, the second thing I'd say, though, the little is that I think that that one thing that a national leader can do in this area is talk about the national consequences. And you've mentioned the environmental consequences, but there are really huge growth consequences. And so that there are a variety of studies that try to estimate the effect of local land use restrictions on national economic activity, and they range in size, but they, and the variety of assumptions they make, but it's very, very big numbers regardless. You're talking in the 2% to some of the things you see 11 or 13% estimates. Those are a little aggressive, I think. But whatever, the federal, they can talk about the ways in which these that states and localities are really hamstringing national economic activity. And one thing when we talk, we put it in the frames about affordability, and it's a valuable frame in which to think about housing. But the absence of ability of people to move to where jobs are, and the absence of people to capture agglomeration economies by firms moving together because they can hire enough workers, really, really limits national economic output. And that's we're in a low growth economic era. And this is a potential tool for actually spurring real economic growth, which is exciting. And national level politicians can do something in the rhetorical space for focusing us on the big national impacts of these local policies.
And that's not necessarily just a partisan framing. This has been taken up more by Democrats, but the sort of pro-growth and pro-mobility, taking down barriers so that people can move between cities to the place that provides them the most opportunity and lets the country grow, there's no reason that that needs to be a partisan issue.
Yeah, I mean, except that, of course, it does imply – the reason you see those big effects is that it implies people leaving some jurisdictions and moving to other jurisdictions. And the reason we have some belief that they'll do that is because we see the housing price differentials, that if the housing prices in San Francisco wouldn't be so high if people didn't want to move there. And it does imply that what would happen if we reduce those things is that people wouldn't live in Nevada, right? They would just leave to go to Los Angeles because it's nicer. Sorry, I'm just insulting jurisdictions left and right. But so I think there are some real questions about the regional effects that may inhibit some of this kumbaya-ishness.
Fair enough. All right. So we're happy to take your questions. And as Richard said, identify yourself. And the closer you can get to putting this in the form of a question rather than a statement, we'd appreciate that. In the back there.
Hi, my name is Daniel Warwick. I'm an advisory neighborhood commissioner in D.C., so one of the most local forms of government. We're talking a lot about state preemption of local zoning regulations. I'm wondering how the conversation changes in jurisdictions where the city is the state to a large extent. One example would be obviously Washington, D.C., also thinking Rhode Island, which is mostly the Providence MSA, even New York State, which is the primary population is in New York City. A lot of the population of New York State is in New York City, or even here in Washington, D.C., where our state elected officials are our city elected officials, and our zoning code isn't enforced by our state/city local elected officials. It's enforced by a zoning commission that's partially federal and partially local. So how do you do state preemption when there isn't always a state to preempt the zoning?
Or we could make D.C. a state, and then we would get around that problem.
Well, I mean, I would say one of the things that sets D.C. apart is its aggressive pro-housing strategies, right? So the mayor has committed to affordable housing going all the way up to 120% of area median income. And I think that because the need is so dire, folks don't necessarily feel it who are living here in D.C., but we're going to see over time a lot more housing coming online.
I don't know that I agree with that, but it's okay. I mean, I think the thing is you could imagine citywide deals that take the basic structure of statewide deals, that you could imagine citywide changes. And we've seen that there's nothing conceptually that's all that distinct from the Minneapolis replanning process and a statewide process that tries to incorporate, so like the California RENA process that gives every place some elements. The big problem in Washington, the biggest structural problem, is the sheer refusal of a large part of the city to allow any new housing of any sort in the richest areas. And that makes it like it's possible that D.C. has fewer solutions because there's no Albany to come in and, well, Albany wouldn't, but there's no Sacramento to come in to do something to Ward 3. But in most places, that hasn't happened in those places either. So I don't know how distinct the problem is in that in many ways.
In some ways, when I think about what makes the political challenges in D.C. distinct, it's less actually the political institutions and more sort of what's been going on in terms of racial politics and the gentrification of communities of color, which I think relates to some of these points that David raised, where there are some neighborhoods in D.C. that have been effectively able to block development, and that has concentrated development into communities of color and created, I think, a really challenging politics when you tell people, oh, we're going to build lots of new housing. Oh, where is that going to go? And are those newcomers going to look at all like the people who used to live there? Are the people who used to live there going to be able to stay there? So that's, I think, somewhat, it's happening in a lot of other cities, but I think D.C. is in many respects at the forefront of those kinds of conversations about race and gentrification.
Yes, up in the front.
Thank you very much. I was a local housing advocate in Arlington County. And I would point out that in Arlington County, in addition to extensive single-family zoning restrictions, they also have an unofficial policy of non-consolidation, which means you can't bring a number of single-family homes together to then site a larger building. But my question actually is, I'm troubled by a definition of middle class that permeates all of this, which seems to rely on two incomes or more, when 50 years ago, housing relied on one income. And that isn't to say I'm not in favor of women working, which I am, but I really wonder if you factored middle class by the fact that it now takes two incomes to follow in a lot of those quadrants, then isn't the housing issue more national by virtue of taking that into account?
So I'll take this because I think it's referring to the presentation. So I did not look at the income per person. I was looking at household income together, in part because the choice of how many people to include in a household is driven by housing costs. So in more expensive places, people are likely to find other people to group together. So for instance, the phenomenon of, you know, a bunch of 20-somethings sharing a house and having a bunch of roommates is almost exclusively a result of high housing costs. And we see that almost entirely in very expensive places. So it's a valid point that one way of getting a bigger income is having more people work in the family, but it also affects the household formation decisions as well.
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm talking about husband and wife. That in a lot of places, whether it's rural Wisconsin or suburban D.C., you need two incomes to support owning a house. A husband and a wife are both working, and part of that reason is to afford housing, or at least
it's possible.
I think
this gets into some other really interesting questions. So in expensive metros, childcare outside the home is almost expensive as another mortgage. So this gets into a lot of really complicated questions about choices about labor supply and subsidies for other kinds of things, but it's an interesting question to think about. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. International Urban Alliance, unpronounceable name. I Thank you for this very exciting exchange. I have a stupid question from an otherwise intelligent person, and that is, what the impact of, say, doubling the property tax or heavily taxing the land be on housing affordability, urban mobility, cutting on commuting, densifying the cities, and not the least, funding schools? Thank you.
I will cheat on that question a little as a political scientist and talk about the political consequences of that kind of decision, which will mean that you as an elected official probably won't have a job anymore if you make that
it's
your policy.
It's bad for employment right now.
It's bad for your job individually. I think we can sort of talk about what the optimal level of taxes are. And I think the next panel is going to think a lot about property taxes and taxation in general. But politically, I suspect that's a hard sell in most places.
And I would add to that by saying, you know, you were voted into office by your current constituents, and current constituents are always going to oppose that, particularly in communities where we see seniors who want to remain in their homes and, because livelihoods are going so long, may have their money run out during retirement. So you mentioned accessory dwelling units. You know, one of the ways to sell those locally is to have existing homeowners who say, I want to make room for my kids who are moving back in, or I need a caretaker on the property, or I simply need the income, and it's not going to impact what the neighborhood looks like at all. I think we're seeing lots of support building for those, but if you have a community even where you can't make that sell to two-thirds, you've got a pretty anti-growth
mindset. I think conceptually it probably would be probably pretty bad for housing construction. The greater local reliance on property taxes, kind of this is like the basic, is that gives places an incentive to try to maximize the average property value per resident, because there's the fiscalization of land use. And kind of in a classic Bruce Hamilton's result, suggests that pure reliance on property tax will create jurisdictions that want to keep housing consumption per capita exactly even across the populace. So this would be largely restrictive. And so to the extent you're talking about local governments raising property taxes, creating a greater share of their revenue from property taxes rather than interlocal transfers or sales taxes or whatever else, it would probably result in less housing construction.
Thank you. So these are European and Asian sins.
One of the things you don't see the extensive localization of property tax revenue in other places the same way degree you do here, so it results in a very different political economy.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think we are going to hear more about sort of the structure of local taxes in the next panel. Let me get to that.
You should have saved it.
That's fine. Yes.
Hi. Ryan Bedard again, Third Way. I had a supply and demand question for housing. In a lot of the most desirable metro areas that are also very expensive, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City, you have a lot of either rich people in the United States who have second homes there, or more often than not, a lot of people who are oligarchs and whatever from other countries that end up laundering their money through real estate, particularly in New York City and Los Angeles and other places like that. So what, if anything, could you do about that, / how big of a problem is it?
It's not that big a problem. So it's the pied-à-terre rate has ticked up a little bit, but it's not to the point of having that huge an effect on housing prices. The foreign ownership of housing is increased quite substantially, whether it's actually foreign or it's foreign registered LLCs. But that actually has no effect on the broader, because if they're renting out the apartment, it doesn't really matter whether it's a local rich guy or a foreign rich guy who's renting out the apartment. The pied-à-terre rate has increased in some of these jurisdictions. I think in many places you've seen a very, very, very negative politics emerge from efforts to stop this. So you've seen in, say, British Columbia, a tax on foreign ownership. That is, you know, like I'd say has some pretty questionable overtones to the policy. There are some discussions about vacancy property tax, vacancy tax rates, in order to encourage.
Which we're actually going to talk about in the next panel.
Okay, I'll leave it alone.
I think broadly
that talking about foreign oligarchs is a way upper middle class people in big cities absolve themselves from the responsibility that they're the ones. I mean, we are the ones, I'm not absolving myself here either, jacking up property values, because it's our demand and not it's not like some foreign Russian dudes.
In the back? Yeah.
I got a clap. Who knew?
Hey, thanks for being here. My name is Alex Dadek, and I'm lucky this is my second Brookings panel I've gotten to attend because I'm in town from Appalachian, Kentucky. And so I was wondering if you all, I mean, it's a future of middle class initiative, and we're talking about a big, broad topic like housing. But it feels like there's a lot of assumptions that are being made about the kind of housing questions we're focusing on. And I was wondering if you could maybe tie it in a little bit more with some of the structural economic conditions that keep like black and brown people out of housing markets with wealth, for example, that they have, and also small cities and even rural areas that have a middle class also. And where, I mean, in our area, in Appalachia, the housing market just doesn't work at all because you can't get appraisal values because nobody's building any affordable housing at all in most of these places. And it would just be great to hear if you could take a, I hate to be that guy, but like if you could take a few minutes for like that other, you know, 30% of the population that doesn't live in the major metro areas, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
In part, I'm an urban economist, and so I study cities because that's what urban economists do. But it's a very good point that housing markets and real estate markets work really differently outside major metropolitan areas in a couple of ways. So the construction costs are much more complicated because you're not building at large scale. You're doing smaller projects. Lending requirements are often quite different as well. We have been focusing mostly on the problem of very high cost places where people can't afford to buy homes. But in, you know, there are large parts of the country and urban areas as well as rural areas where housing prices are actually very low. And in some sense, you have the opposite problem. They're not good vehicles for wealth building because prices don't appreciate. And in some cases, you can't get a loan to buy a house. So I have a colleague in Akron who says you can buy a very nice house in Akron for $30,000 or $40,000. Banks aren't interested in offering mortgages on a $30,000 or $40,000 home because there's essentially no money to be made in that. So it's a very good point. The Future of the Middle Class initiative is not focused solely on high growth places. So this panel has been focused on that. But we're very conscious that much of the country spatially and a lot of the people in the country don't live in these high cost areas. And there are some very distinct problems that should be addressed. And that's it's worth reminding us that we need to spend some time on that. So thanks.
I would add, I think that the core of the problem is the same in rural America as it is in urban America, that inflation and construction costs have so vastly outpaced wages, yeah. Right? So all the people who are working, if just working, whether it's one person in a family or two people in a family, just working a job were enough to afford housing, we would probably have enough goodwill to take care of elders and low-income people, disabled people who are unable to work, and we would have our housing problem go away. But that's, you know, the stark reality is it's very different. And to your point about appraisals, I went out to Kentucky and had a developer explain to me that it's so hard to bring in capital and get those appraisals that the first thing they do in creating a development is completely finish two units that the developer finances just to then have some comparables on the books. That's something I find deeply sympathetic about the fact that there's just not been capital out there for construction.
I think one other thing that I would add, too, is that zoning has absolutely contributed to racial segregation, not just in the sort of high-cost metropolitan areas that have dominated this conversation, but across the country. I mentioned that we found these dynamics in places like Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is obviously not a rural area, but it is not one of these high-cost metropolitan areas that we've talked about. Zoning is absolutely used as a tool by people, advantaged people in these communities, to stop people who don't look like them from moving in. So I think that's one important point. The second point, too, is, all of these sort of housing challenges, both in rural communities and in urban communities, have been dramatically affected by federal government cutbacks in this arena. And so when we think about the dramatic federal government retrenchment over the last 3 to 4 decades, right, this is why we're having a conversation about how we can reform zoning to build more housing. It's not that we think that this is going to be the perfect solution and that this is not going to be, you know, we're not going to be able to build enough affordable housing to meet everyone's needs without massive federal government reinvestment in this arena. And that's true for rural and urban areas.
Yes, on the aisle here. The woman in the jacket. Yes.
Thank you. Ricky Kramer, I'm an independent researcher and also active in redevelopments in Washington to preserve social diversity in our our extremely aggressive redevelopment policy. There's been relatively, because you're talking about the need to increase the supply of housing, which I understand, and we're saturated with that discussion, I don't find a lot of discussion now on preservation tactics. So that every time we're, for instance, in Washington, we're building, you've just cited that Washington is progressive in terms of its concern about building affordable housing. There is no way that the policies, as progressive as they may be, and our housing trust fund, which has been pumped up even a little bit more this year than last, that we're going to catch up to maintaining any kind of level of affordable housing. And so with that goes racial discrimination and obviously income discrimination. And Jenny, your data that you presented in the beginning is clearly the problem is at the low end. It's not at the, in terms of housing of absolute supply, the problem is at the low end. So I'd just like to hear all of you, and I'm sure it's also a question of the next panel in terms of tax incentives. Keep retiring affordable housing, which then ramps up the gentrification problems. Just what we do about preservation in general.
So I think one just really quick point to make is that we can't get private developers to build affordable housing unless they can also build market rate housing. That's sort of, those two need to be coming together in order for those projects to be profitable. And, you know, again, if we're talking about a place where the federal government has massively disinvested from this arena, this is sort of what we're left with in an era of disinvestment, is that we need to have market rate housing along with subsidized housing. I don't know if folks want to add in.
And I would say the federal government needs to double down on its investment. So we need to see an increase in low-income housing tax credits and in HUD programs to spur the development of housing, because the middle class is fighting with the lower-income folks for the same units, because the lower-income folks are paying so much to just to be able to find something.
Yeah. I mean, that's
a public housing policy that's allowing the public housing to deteriorate and be essentially ultimately taken off the market. That is a huge thing that we don't talk about a lot, and it seems to be, I mean, it's just enormous. And in Washington, certainly, and in many places in the United States, the level of IZ requirement is so much lower than, I'd like to hear you talk about affordability when you say that they can't afford to build housing. It's a very low threshold in most places.
So we could definitely have an entire other panel on inclusionary zoning and preservation, but we're actually out of time, and we want to give everybody a chance to have a little bit of a break before we come back. So join me in thanking our panelists, and then we'll take about a 15-minute break.